I figured you had not enough fake news in your life would bring it into the sanctuary this morning. I like the last part of that. Don't read all about it. Stop. Use reason. That is the truth right there. One of my favorite musicians, believe it or not because of his beautiful voice, but for what he says, is Bob Dylan. And he has this song called Things Have Changed, which is just a good song all around. But he has this line that for me stood out today. And the line says this, that all the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. In John chapter 18, Jesus is on trial before the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. So let's just jump. We know some of that story. Let's just jump into these two verses. If you don't mind, you're going to be sitting for a while. Let's just stand. There's something about, let's read the scripture together. And I ask Julie to read just two verses. She'll read that over us, and I'll say the word of the Lord, and we'll respond, thanks be to God. But just hear these short two verses. Think of all that's packed into this.
Therefore, Pilate said to
them, the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
All right, you can have a seat. 1881, the great Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky died, and his eulogy was given by a poet, philosopher, you might not have heard of him, named Vladimir Solovyov, which I love those names. But this man recognized Dostoevsky as more than just a great novelist. He saw him and he felt like he functioned like a spiritual prophet to the Russian people. And here's what he said at his eulogy. So pay attention, because everything else flows out of this. And I mean, who wouldn't listen to that dude anyway? I mean, his name's Solovyov and he looks like that. I'm listening. The first precondition of being called a spiritual leader is to perceive and feel the falsehood that is prevailing in society. And then to dedicate one's life to struggle against that falsehood. If one tolerates the falsehood and resigns oneself to it, one can never become a prophet. If one cannot rise above material life, one cannot even become a citizen in the kingdom of the Spirit, far less a leader of others. So can you feel it? It's all around you. Can you feel the fakeness, the falseness that sits like a wet blanket over society? I would offer you the fakeness is really strong right now. I think it's a dangerous time. I just read an article recently about how much news and where you get it. Often people are pumping stories that are the opposite of what the truth is, but people don't know it. They just read it and say, well, it comes from a news source. So it's a dangerous time that we live in. Most people, I think, are so buzzed off the secondhand smoke of consumer culture that they don't even recognize anything's going on. We assume that this is just life. I think other people, they feel it. They feel like something's wrong, but they don't know quite how to put their finger on it. And I would say it takes a prophet to label it. And of all the prophets who have ever felt the fakeness and dared to resist it and speak against it, the greatest by far is Jesus of Nazareth. Now, you were hoping I was going to end like that, didn't you? You knew I was going to say that. The witness of Jesus is the very spirit of prophecy. And perhaps one of his greatest moments is when he stood trial, which we just read those two verses. And so let's go there for a moment. Jesus has just experienced betrayal and arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane, which I mean, that's pretty significant to go. Our Lord knows what it's like in your darkest moment to have people turn their back on him. He knows what it's like to be falsely accused. God knows what it's like to be arrested. In the dead of night, he is taken to this hastily convened gathering of a religious council known as the Sanhedrin. And in the middle of the night, he faces this kind of trial and basically is condemned for blasphemy because he has claimed to be the Messiah, God's anointed one. And the Sanhedrin, understand, they are determined to execute him. That isn't a question. They don't want to do it themselves. Matter of fact, they can't because they're occupied by Rome. And only Romans are allowed to execute. But at dawn, Jesus is taken from the house of Caiaphas, which I think would be a great title to a song if someone wants to write that. But he's taken from this religious trial, house of Caiaphas, to the Praetorium of Pilate. Now, try to imagine this in your mind. The Praetorium is lined with marble. Like it's stately and regal. And when Jesus enters, there sits Pilate, donned in the garb of Roman power. Behind him is the imperial seal. Everything is communicating official grandeur. Jesus hasn't spent a lot of time here because he was born among the poor. Remember, this Jesus is one who has no place to lay his head. But here he finds himself surrounded by the glory of the governor's palace. It's all the pomp and circumstance of Rome. And imagine, it helps with these stories. Picture yourself there. Pilate moves to the heart of the matter, and he bluntly asks Jesus, so are you a king? You know, all this time we assumed that Herod was the king of the Jews because, you know, Caesar designated him as that. So are you saying you're the king? I so love Jesus in these moments. Jesus just has this kind of enigmatic way of saying, you know, will you say that I am? I mean, it's as you say. So picture this. Jesus, you're there. Jesus is on trial before the governor. Really, Jesus is on trial before the Roman Empire. And in one sense, Jesus is on trial before all of the world because Rome kind of represents the world in all of its, you know, all of its glory. Jesus is really on trial by the foundation of Western civilization. Think of that. At its pinnacle, at its zenith, like so noble and regal. Now remember, 3 years earlier, Jesus had already faced some of these things in a wilderness temptation because for just a token of compromise, he was offered kind of the fast track, like he could have become the next rising star, the next Caesar, the next president, if he would just give this little token of compromise. And Jesus rejected all that by saying, you should worship the Lord your God only, and him only should you serve. So he spurned the empire. So the empire strikes back, which would be a great title for a movie. And Pilate says, are you a king? Jesus says, you say that I am. But at this time, he adds, for this purpose, I have come into the world to bear witness to the truth. And anybody that is acquainted with truth will hear me. So imagine as Jesus stands there, he feels the falseness. He sees beyond the marble inlay and the stately attire and all the symbols of power. He sees that that's all built on this giant falsehood. He knows this inside, dares to speak it. Jesus knows that the world that started to get birthed or bloom in Cain, you know Cain, Cain's the one who killed his brother, says he moves east of Eden. East of Eden is always in a direction opposite of God. And he starts the first city or civilization. So Jesus knows that the world that started to bloom and that was formed in Cain, that was inherited by all the ancient pharaohs and all the great kings of history and all the Caesars in the world at this time, that underneath all of that is untruth, or what we might call in our day and age fake news. Jesus feels this, and he says this, for this purpose I have come to bear witness. That's the prophetic nature of Jesus, to bear witness to the truth. And if anybody has even the slightest draw towards truth, they will hear what I have to say. So Jesus knows that people who have not been completely overtaken by the spirit of falsehood will hear what he says, maybe cock their head a little bit, maybe have that itch. They'll think about it and they'll say, this one probably has something to offer. So imagine that. I mean, this is where I feel like Lewis is right, and I don't know really how you debate your way around this. I mean, either Jesus is a complete and utter lunatic, or he is one of the greatest actors of all time. I mean, he's about to get beaten, and he says this, or he might be right. I mean, you kind of make your choice there. I mean, think of that, standing before the Roman elite and looking at them and saying, this is why I was born, so I could come into the world and expose falseness and reveal the truth and reality. And if you all want to know truth, then you will hear me. Yowzers. You will hear me. Which now, do you see what just happened there? Jesus completely just changed the nature of truth. We think of truth as true statements. doctrinal statements in the church or bullet points, factual information. Jesus just took truth and said, it's a person. I am truth. Well, that just changes the whole nature of it. And of course, then we have, that's probably one of my favorite parts, then we have Pilate's legendary reply, what is truth? Cynical reply of a politician. Don't you just love on TV when politicians go rogue? And they try to preach and do theology, and they use scripture to kind of buttress their position. Suddenly, our old friend Pilate is a philosopher. Jesus, what is truth? And then Pilate sends Jesus to the barracks, which is the fortress where the Roman soldiers stay when they're in Jerusalem. And he sends Jesus to be scourged, because he can. And while Jesus is in this process, the soldiers in the barracks, they know what is happening. They're up on the news. I don't know how they did it in their day, but they know that here's this Jewish peasant from Galilee, of all places, who seems to have this small following of people that would say he is the chosen one. He is the king of the Jews. So we know this story. They're a little bit bored. They decide to have a little fun with it. Somebody says, well, he's a king. I mean, a good king has to have a nice robe. That isn't really kingly attire that he's wearing, so somebody goes and fetches a cape, the imperial purple, from a Roman officer, and they put it on him, and you can imagine calling him your majesty. Somebody else says, well, if he's a king, he needs a scepter, so somebody goes and finds a reed and hands it to him. And somebody says, oh, what good king doesn't have a crown? Think of Genesis. They ironically put together thorns and thistles and jam it on the scalp of the Creator. And basically, they begin to play Hail, Hail the King, Hail the Chief. So you look at this moment and you say, what is this? Well, of course, it's cruel mockery. But what really is this? It's the coronation of the world's true king. That's what it is. Now, obviously, they meant this as a moment of mockery, but think of this. Thousands of years later, we who sit here and confess Jesus as Lord understand that some in ironic way, they got it right. Because this is the king coming in his glory. This here is how Christ becomes king. Because we claim the death of Jesus on the cross is actually a victory. And you realize what we believe, how nuts it is? You forget that sometimes, that in this moment of utter humiliation and defeat, the worst moment in somebody's life, we look at and say, that is a window into the way God wins, because in this moment, as he's being crushed, he's releasing divine love and forgiveness and salvation into all the scattered parts of the cosmos. But that's pretty nuts. That is the coronation ceremony of the world's rightful leader. With a reed for a scepter and thorns for a crown and a borrowed robe, and eventually there will even be a throne, but it will look and feel like a cross. So he's moved back from the barracks, back to Pilate, and he's still in this kingly garb. And imagine Pilate. Pilate kind of joins in the mockery for a moment. He parades Jesus in front of people and says, behold your king. Here he is, your king. And then Pilate goes on to interrogate Jesus more, and he asks him this, where are you from? And this time Jesus is silent because he has nothing more to say, and so he doesn't answer. And this infuriates Pilate, and he explodes and he shouts, don't you know I have the power to release you or the power to crucify you? Basically saying, Jesus, don't you know who I am? The key here is, listen, you got to listen to these stories. Do you know I have power? You won't talk to me? I have power. I have the power of life and death. And there it is, friends. Have you ever noticed in this text that Pilate answers his own question from earlier? What is truth? Truth is power. The truth is, I have power over you. I can release you and you can go your way with your delusions of grandeur, or I can crucify you, but that is the truth. What is truth? Power over, right? Power to kill. That is ultimate reality. I seek and love this story so much because imagine this in your mind. Jesus just said, I came into this world to bear witness to the truth. Pilate just bears witness to his truth. So what do you have? A collision of gospels. Here's Jesus' good news. Here's Pilate's good news. And they collide together in this moment. They're kind of evangelizing each other, if you will. We say in this culture, I don't always like this, what is your truth? Speak your truth. Well, Pilate does, and according to Pilate, the world is run by men of power. Military power, economic power, religious power, armies, economies, temples. This is what makes the world go round. Generals, billionaires, high priests like Pilate, like King Herod, like Caesar, like Caiaphas. In Pilate's world, power trumps everything else. Now understand this. Jesus has already, it's such a beautiful scene. Jesus has already faced down all of this falseness in his wilderness experience. Because one of the way of thinking of the temptations is this. Economic temptations, religious temptations, political temptations. Think of what Satan said to Jesus. Jesus, these rocks. Turn them to bread. People are hungry. They like bread. Make bread for them. You'll be their leader. They'll follow you. Give them what they want. Okay, Jesus, you don't want to do that? Go to the top of the temple and jump off. Show them what you got. Show them how close you are to God and how he'll always save you. People love a good circus. Do a stunt. Jesus, don't bypass the way of the cross. Take it by force. Become the next rising star, for heaven's sake. Become the next king or Caesar and just take it by force like Alexander the Great did. The world's yours. You don't got to go the way of the cross. No one else has. What does Jesus say? It is written, man shall not live by bread alone. It is written. Now I'm forgetting the second one. It is written, worship the Lord your God only, and him only should you serve. It is written, do not test the Lord your God. You see, what Pilate doesn't realize is that Jesus has already passed the test and resisted the seduction of power, the world, the flesh, the devil. But for Pilate, the truth is power is everything. And notice how everybody around him gets caught up in that. Even Caiaphas. Because I feel like here's the worst moment. We didn't read it today, but you probably are familiar enough with the story. Pilate parades Jesus in front of the people and he says, behold your king. And what does Caiaphas say? We have no king but Caesar. The Jewish high priest just said, our king is Caesar. Huh? I mean, with a complete betrayal of everything that the Moses and the prophets and the whole of the Hebrew tradition stood for, he just said, our king is Caesar. I mean, that is a real moment of truth, friends. That's some stunning honesty. We have no king but Caesar. Here's what I think happens. This is my guess. Here's what happens in that moment. Caiaphas takes off his clerical collar, and he says, look, governor, we all have a role to play in this world, and my role is religion, but the truth is, and I get it, that the world is run by men of power like you, like King Herod, and of course, all hail Caesar. So if I'm going to be anybody, if I'm going to do anything in this world, I'm going to have to embrace this. I get it. The world turns on the axis of power. I understand that. We have no king but Caesar. So I'm going to put my clerical collar back on, and I'm going to do my high priest type stuff. But at least both of us now know where I stand, that I get it. The truth of power trumps everything else. And I got to tell you, friends, right there is the lie. Woven right into our holy scriptures as it's narrating for us a specific moment in the life of Jesus, his trial, that is the falseness that prevails in society. Do you feel that? The great lie is that life somehow is about the acquisition of money, which is things and experiences that we can have, and forms of power. The lie is that the abundant life is somehow about proximity to power. Political power, religious power, economic power, Have we not observed the fakeness of all that? I would say to you, resist this at all costs. Don't accept this in any form that it comes to you, because I feel like we don't understand how we are barraged by this through every article, through every news show, through everything that we encounter in a given day. Don't accept this in any form. Learn to rise above it and see it for what it is. Because the truth of the matter is, Cain was wrong. Life is not about winning and conquering your brother to do so. Life is about loving your brothers and your sisters. Remember, Cain snidely asked, "Am I my brother's keeper?" And the answer is yes. Yes, you are. That's exactly it. Cain, you are your brother's keeper. The only thing that you have to do in life, now think of this. We think that we're pretty important. We have all this manner of stuff to get done. The only thing that you have to do in life is this: love God and love your brothers and your sisters. That's it. That's what you have to do. Because if you don't love God, you're not going to really love anything beyond yourself. So love him with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and then love your neighbor as yourself. That's it. Cain was wrong. Pharaoh was wrong. The great kings of history were often wrong. Pilate was wrong. Caesar was wrong. Nietzsche was wrong. God has not totalized will to power. I mean, at least Nietzsche was honest. He just put it out there. The greatest thing is power in the world, you know. But God isn't totalized will to power. Friends, think of the kenosis, self-emptying. God is self-sacrificial love. The purpose of life is to love. Life is not about power. The meaning of life is not found in power, but the meaning of life is love. Life is not a competition, because we often view that way, where it is us versus them, but life is a gift. So the goal of life isn't to win. The goal of life is to learn to love well. The goal of life is to learn to love well. And unless you love, your life will flash by in meaninglessness. I think we underestimate how we are formed, raised, schooled, taught from a very early age that in many sense, people might not just say it out in this open, but that life is about winning and losing. Success. You gotta get ahead. You gotta study now in fourth grade and learn these facts, or you won't make it to, you know. Success or not success. I think as Americans, that is our default setting. And then what happens is we classify and divide people as winners or losers. You know. Think of the things we say. You gotta get ahead. It's a dog eat dog world, man. Call your way to the top. Look out for number one. Take care of you. If they hit you, hit them right back. That's the American motto. And yet, I think Jesus would hear all those and say, that there is the highway to hell. That is a really broad approach that actually leads in destruction. Jesus would say, I would have you enter in by a narrow gate. You say, what is the narrow gate? Well, he says it in the very same passage. What you would have others do to you, do to them. It's not always easy, requires effort. Jesus says, that's what leads to life. Sometimes I think about what will it look like? I think it's different than we picture Jesus on a horse coming out of the sky. I don't know if that's going to be it, but I feel like Jesus is already close. We just kind of have this veil, and it's like suddenly the veil's gone, and bam, he's there. What will that look like when you have a moment with Jesus and you look into those very loving but also piercing eyes that see through all facades? I feel like maybe if there's any question, that it'll just be one question. Shane, did you learn to love? Did you learn to love? How did you love? No? I don't know that he's interested in that much else. Tell me how that you love. Because life isn't this competitive game, but that it is a gift given. It is a gift given to you by God, your very being, your existence, your consciousness, your coming and your going, and all your experiences, all of that is gift. I put this picture up because one author, and this has always stayed with me, said, picture the events of your day coming to you as gift wrap, because they're all gifts. It's a gift. It's not a game where you try and get the most points and get ahead and win and beat the other and take out Abel if you have to in the process. I mean, what do we think that Jesus meant when he said, I'm going to bring the government of God, the rule and the reign of God, and I'm bring it to bear on earth. And in this rule, the first will be last. Those in the very back will be brought to the front of the line. I mean, the whole thing, Jesus said, is pretty topsy-turvy and upside down and not at all what you expect. And so many of those so-called losers might actually be ahead of you. And I got to tell you, the people in Jesus' day, they got it because eventually they tried to kill him. They understood what he was saying. I feel like we've grown up in church and Sunday school and we had all the flannel graph stories told us. And we just, that's a nice saying of Jesus and we don't get it. Think of a lot of people throughout history that we would admire, that we would put on a pedestal, that we'd say, man, what a great view of leadership. And certainly they did have good things about them, but that they were wrong. They were wrong. I got to tell you, though, the most wrong of all to me is Caiaphas. You ever watch, any of you watch ESPN? My favorite thing on ESPN is they'll show sports highlights of people like dropping a ball or not getting it right. And one of the players always goes, come on, man, at the end of it. It's just funny to see all these mistakes people will make in a given game and they yell out, come on, man. And that's why when I think of Caiaphas, I think, come on, man. You know, Caiaphas, he was the most wrong on Good Friday. I mean, think of this. Kings and generals and presidents and politicians, if you haven't gotten this by now, we should probably understand what they're up to. That doesn't mean they don't have anything good about them, but most of them show their cards to you and they're about power. But for priests and pastors and faith-based leaders, it should be different. Caiaphas is part of an ancient Israelite tradition that says, who is king? God. God is king. I mean, think of all the psalms that Caiaphas led, that he chanted with the people every day. He would gather the people together and say what? Yahweh is king. The Lord is king. The king sits on his holy hill. Right? And yet here in this moment, he stands and he says, we have no king but power. That's not what he actually said, but that's what he means, right? Caiaphas doesn't believe in Caesar. Caiaphas believes in Caesar's power. What Caiaphas wants is proximity to the most powerful man in the world. He wants his invitation to the White House. I don't mean, my bad, Imperial Palace. Sorry. He wants to be close to power. That's his opiate of choice. That's his addiction. I'm going to say something maybe a little intense for some of you, or a little harsh sounding, but I mean this with everything in me. When faith leaders and people of faith sell themselves, position themselves, or prostitute themselves for political power, it is a complete and utter betrayal of their high calling. The meaning of life, the meaning of Christianity is not in power, but it is in love. Notice the scripture. It doesn't say God is power. He is powerful. But what does it say? God is love. The world's rightful leader comes among his people in complete powerlessness, and then he assumes his throne, which is a cross, and that is his glory. Balthazar, which is, again, a great name, says this, being disguised under the disfigurement of an ugly crucifixion and death, the Christ upon the cross is paradoxically the clearest revelation of who God is. That is the crazy, foolish message that we believe, that somehow a man writhing in pain, receiving capital punishment in the first century, is somehow a mirror into who God really is. and that He is love. He is love. Generals don't tend to believe this, I understand. Billionaires tend not to think in those terms, I get it. But the high priest is supposed to. Pilate isn't into this. But Caiaphas, come on, man. The summary of the law and the prophets is love God and love your neighbor. But there he stands. We have no king but Caesar. I got to tell you, I feel like the church in America has taken its true power, which is weakness, and sold it for the kind of power that everybody else wants. And the reason that there's no power in the church is because we're following the way of Caiaphas, not the way of Jesus. That the Caiaphas legend kind of lives on through us, and we often stand there and say, well, we have no party but this, you know, Republicans, Democrats. I said, that's not me. Well, what do you spend your time? Where's your focus? What do you absorb the most? If people were around you, would they say, wow, yeah, they trust in that. They sing at church, we trust in the name of the Lord our God. Some people trust in horses and chariots, but not us. We trust in the name of the Lord our God. Could the American church say that? I don't think so. I think we spend a lot of time talking about horses and chariots. That's our focus, that's our worry, that's our concern. I know people who've been sick over which person comes into office and they're sick for months and they've and I go, whoa. But then stand in church and why we trust in the name of the Lord our God. No, let's be honest. The way of Caiaphas over the way of Jesus. Caiaphas sold his soul to power, and I wonder if he ever heard Jesus say, what did you gain? What did you profit from that? You landed here, you got the world, in one sense you got your power, but you lost yourself, you disintegrated your center. I feel like in that moment, Caiaphas doesn't feel the falseness because he has become the falseness. Woe to leaders of faith, woe to communities of faith, woe to people of faith who become the falseness, that just are on autopilot and go with the flow and kind of look at everything. Yeah, that's the way. When you see people of faith and faith leaders strategizing and jockeying for positions so that they have proximity to political power so that they can control things, don't you feel the falseness of that? Don't you see that their confession is that moment, we have no king but Caesar? Yeah, we do the Sunday thing where we sing and we believe, say, God is sovereign, but really, it's about getting this person in office so he can pass this laws so that the country can get back to the good old days where there was slavery and everything else. So I always kind of scratch, but what were the good old days? There was always, in any era that you live in, there were these things that like were probably good and maybe virtuous, but then there were things that were like, eh, wasn't so good. I don't know that I want to go back there. But you see that is a complete betrayal that everything the king is about across, and then let's fix everything so we can take it back. I don't know that that's language that Jesus would have ever used. Let's Israelites band together and let's take it back and bring it back. I think more than ever, we live in an economic, military superpower, and to feel like we're ever going to be the majority is nuts. It's nuts. Instead, God never asks us to win. He asks us to be faithful. What would it look like if Christians were just a faithful counterculture? That doesn't mean you don't vote or do anything else. It just means, man, focus your energies on living the Sermon on the Mount. Being right with your enemies, being forgiving towards people, accepting people of different races and religions, like being what Jesus asked us to be. What if that was the focus instead? I got to tell you, I feel like that would do more for politics than what you vote on any given year. Your politics is what you do every day. How you spend your money, how you treat people, how you your worldview. See? Some trust in horses and chariots. We trust in the name of the Lord our God. The way of Caiaphas. I mean, you got all these kind of ways. There's the Pilate way, which is kind of like Caiaphas. Caiaphas did it under the guise of religion, though, where there is the way of Jesus. Caiaphas' way, I gotta be honest, Caiaphas' way is easier. In one sense, it's broad. Lots of people do it. You'll have plenty of friends along the way. Jesus' way, when you really look at it, wow, it is, woof, it's limiting sometimes. I don't get to punch this person in the face when they're annoying me. You know? Kind of narrow now. That probably isn't the best approach. This approach, and it's tight. But it leads to life. I got to tell you this. I am determined, whatever time I have left, to be the resistance. I like the name The Dwelling Place. It came from, I had a list. I should show you the list someday of names because it was important to me. I didn't want to be tied to, you know, First Baptist has been used several times. I didn't want that. I was reading the Psalms one day and it said, "Oh Lord, you are a dwelling place." And then it was weird. Like a day later, I read Ephesians. It's like, it just started popping out to me. It's like Ephesians said, "You are the dwelling place." And I love that because it's like, we come to church, this is the dwelling place of God, but we are the dwelling place of God. So I love our name. But if I had to change it, and this is maybe the comic book geek in me, it would be the resistance. Because I feel like we need something intense to remind us that, nah, you're called to swim against the tide. That doesn't mean you know, we're not necessarily doing it the Amish way. They've certainly got some good things. We're not just by the way we wear and all that. No, but you are overall in culture, by the way that you handle yourself, by the way you're swimming against the tide. It is a resistance. I think the church has lost that. That's why I like that name. Because we are the resistance to struggle against the lie. Here's what I want. I want my praying, my spirituality, my preaching, what we talk about and do in here, I want it to be this persistent resistance to the falseness that prevails in society. Can you feel it out there? If you can, that's good, because it means you have a heart that bends towards the truth. And so keep feeding that holy instinct. And we'll end with this. You say, well, how? Like, I agree, we're supposed to be the resistance, and I need to keep feeding that and constantly look at things like Jesus. I'm standing in the Praetorium, but I see past the marble and the Roman seals, and I see the foundation is untruth and fake news. So how do I do it? Well, keep listening. I'm making this as simple. Keep listening to the truth that is Jesus. I've told you this a million times. I would rather you listen to silly radio preachers than Fox News. I would rather listen to you, because some of those are radiology, you know, I call it radio orthodoxy, and it's like, okay, some of it's good, so, you know. I would rather us listen to that, though, than to keep pouring into, and then you're saying, oh, I got to keep updated. Yeah, fine, keep updated. I'm simply saying, keep listening to the truth that is Jesus. Flood your ears and your minds with him, and you will win. Not in the sense of the world. I think I've already made that clear. But you'll win. That'll be right. Which means, you know, podcast, read. You guys are good at that. Read, pour your mind and stuff. Be here regularly, because what we're trying to do is shape all of us in such a way to be the resistance. Be here. Listen to this. Be discerning. I'm not always right. Discern it. But do that. Does that make sense? Keep listening to the truth that is Jesus. Let that be the majority of what goes in. Also do this. Keep believing in the truth that Jesus is. I think it's getting tougher in society, and I'm watching young people drop like flies. And I understand a lot of them look at and they see the falseness that prevails in the church, and I agree. So there ain't no judgment from me. But I see a lot of people when the going get tough. It's this illusion that I've come to Jesus, so now the road is going to be good. Not, you chose a narrow route, dude. It's going to be rough. Sometimes. And other times it's going to be good. But keep believing in the truth. He's changed the nature of truth. Truth is a person. You're not right because your theology right. You're right because you have union with Christ. You're connected to him, and he is truth, and he is goodness. Let that flow in you. And then this, seek to live out the truth that Jesus calls us to do. Practice it. The faith wasn't meant to go, oh, I'm a Christian, and it's a title. No, no, no. tomorrow, practice it. Wake up tomorrow morning. To me, it's this simple. Say, Jesus, I'm going to listen to the truth. I believe you're still speaking, so I'm going to stop in my day. In this busy culture, I'm going to be counterculture, and I'm going to stop, and I'm not going to always pray and give you my items of request, but I'm just going to contemplate a prayer. Listen. And I'll fill my mind with things that are good. I'm going to keep believing. I'm going to keep the faith. And I'm going to today try to practice. I know what you've taught. I mean, we go over it here, true, but you know. A person's in front of you, love them. Listen to them. Accept them. They might be wildly different than you. Accept them in the name of Jesus. How would Jesus look at them? Ask. I sometimes do that. God, let my eyes and my listening convey how good you are to this person. See, practice it. Does that make sense? Listen to the truth that Jesus is. Keep believing. Keep the faith. Ask God. You say, man, there probably are struggles ahead. I have no idea that are coming. So help me keep the faith because Jesus is the truth. And then seek out to live the truth that Jesus calls us to. Because here's my prayer. I would pray that the dwelling place, and I pray this for every church in Indianapolis. That's as far as I can think. I know there's other ones, but that's what I thought of today. That we would all be, you think all the churches in Indianapolis, you would think the church would be far more prophetic than it is. I pray that we would be a prophetic people who, having felt the falseness in society, we abide in the truth, which is Jesus. My dear Wormwood, be sure that the patient remains completely fixated on politics. Arguments, political gossiping, and obsessing on the faults of people they have never met serves as an excellent distraction from advancing in personal virtue, character, and the things that the patient can control. Make sure to keep the patient in a constant state of angst, frustration, and general disdain towards the rest of the human race in order to avoid any kind of charity or inner peace from further developing. Ensure the patient continues to believe that the problem is out there in the broken system rather than recognizing there is a problem with himself. Keep up the good work, Uncle Screwtape.